Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome. You're tuned into Life is a Sacred Journey. Every week, we bring a new perspective to aging and caregiving. Here is your host, Michelle Pope.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to all of you out there in the virtual neighborhood of Life is a Sacred Journey. My name is Michelle Pope, and it is my honor to be here with you again Friday morning at 8 a.m. The sun is coming up here in California, a little foggy this morning, and I am so happy to have my new friend, Lynn Castile-Hopper. Some of you have been with us because we've been having a sidebar before we've gone live, and I'll tell you a little bit more about her in a few minutes, but welcome, Lynn. It's so good to be with you this morning, and I thank you for, because you're in New York, so it's already a little later in the morning, right?
On the East Coast here, yes. Yeah. I'm actually in Maine, but
okay.
Yeah, same time.
Okay. So welcome, and I really appreciate your taking the time to join us this morning. I'm going to say a few words this morning, and Lynn probably knows about this gentleman. I did not know about this, and I heard it coming into the office this morning on NPR that Rafer Johnson, who was the African-American who won the 1960 decathlon and also subdued the assassin of Robert F. Kennedy, he passed away on Wednesday at 86 years old. And so, you know, I always like to lift up those people in our lives who did something. They made a change, you know, and as I've always said to all of you, being in the world is about being in action. Action is doing something that may be very tiny. It may be the move of a caterpillar, but it changes the world for everybody after that moment. And so we just say, God bless you, Rafer Johnson, and thank you for your sacrifices to this world and to our community. And as a athlete, I am so proud. Not that I ever met you, but you were an inspiration to me as an athlete when I was a young woman. And so, you know, thank you so much in high school running and trying to play basketball that I didn't do very well. So, Rafer Johnson, rest in peace, and thank you so much for your contribution to Black community, to the Black community, to the community, the human community, and to the athletic world. We will miss you, and thank you. So I had the honor. I'm going to tell this story. I just told this story to Lynn. So I like to read the books of everybody that comes or the papers, or I try to really dig deep. Like with Chris Bravo, I looked at a lot of his documentaries just to get the heart of the person so that I can lead a conversation that engages all of you. Because if it's not authentic, you're not going to be interested and you won't come back. And I ordered on Amazon this book on vanishing, and we're going to talk about it in a minute, and it didn't come. And Amazon sent me that wonderful little note, you know, it's coming, but and the date was not the date that I wanted it. So I called Barnes & Noble. Thank you, Barnes & Noble, for being back open in our community. And they didn't have it. So then they went online and told me, for those of you in the Bay Area, Lynn, they told me a community that was close to my job, and then they told me a community that was 45 miles away from my job where I could find it. So last night I went to the El Cerrito Barnes & Noble. Thank you to the young man behind the counter. You are an amazing young man, and God bless you in your future. He and I chopped it up about this book. He had not heard about the book, but he was holding it for me, and we talked a lot about it. So I think he went and got another copy. But it's called On Vanishing, Mortality, Dementia, and What It Means to Disappear. And Lynn Castile-Hopper is the author and our guest this morning at Life is a Sacred Journey. I want to tell you a little bit about Lynn because I think it's important to do that. So I have her bio in front of me. And one of the things that resonated for all of you who know Michelle Pope that popped off the page when I saw Lynn's bio is that she is a minister and a chaplain. And of course she is. I kept thinking to myself, yeah, of course she is. And she's the author of On Vanishing, the book that I just held up for you. And it explores the spirituality and social justice around dementia. And she does it in a way, words that are just powerful words that resonate, but they're positive words. They're not negative words to take you, as I always say to you, into that doomy, gloomy place where we usually take people when we hear the word Alzheimer's or we hear the word dementia, when in fact we don't have to do that. Yes, I always say to people, the diagnosis is terrible, it's an ugly disease, there is no cure, oh my gosh, that's just awful. But as long as the person is alive and among us, we have the opportunity to get to know that individual and to move closer to that spirit place with that individual, and Lynn talks about that in this book. Let me tell you some more. She has worked with and appeared in the Kenyon Review Online, the Huffington Post, the North American Review, the Journal of Religion and Abuse, and elsewhere. She received the New Delta Review Nonfiction Prize in 2013, yay, and the RSN Anthology 2017 Nonfiction Award. And she was named the runner-up for the Torch Prize in 2016. Again, as I said, Lynn is an ordained Baptist minister, and she got her MDiv, which at Wake Forest University, and her chaplaincy residency at Robert Wood Johnson University Hospital. Lynn has served as the nursing home chaplain and continues to work with continuing care communities on the New Jersey Shore, or did that for 7 years. And she is currently the minister of older adults at the Riverside Church in the city of New York. And originally from Southeast Missouri, Lynn lives in New York with her husband, Mr. Ryan Harper. And but they are quarantining and sheltering in place in Maine. And so welcome, Lynn Castile Harper, to Life is a Sacred Journey. It is my honor and privilege to have you among my virtual family this morning. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for joining us at Life is a Sacred Journey. So, Lynn, this book, I want to ask one thing first before you delve into your story. I love the idea on vanishing. This says volumes before I even opened the book. I have it marked where that's how far I got. On vanishing, this says a lot to me. So can you speak a little bit about why these two words were chosen to be the title of your book?
Sure. Thank you, Michelle. Thank you. I'm so humbled to be here and for that beautiful introduction.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much. And if I can just say, I was so drawn to the name, Life is a Sacred Journey. What a beautiful name for a show and a podcast. So I'm grateful to be a part, and thank you for having me. Vanishing is such a compelling word to me when we talk about dementia. And what I noticed in my work with people living with dementia is that often what surrounds them is a language of vanishing. You know, people will say they're fading or gone or leaving us, or they're dying, a certain death of themselves even while they're still living. And so we hear that a lot in our culture. Even in, you know, the New York Times will talk about Alzheimer's stealing someone as if they're being kidnapped or vanished.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have this very negative language we use around vanishing. Part of the book is I want to push back against that. I want to say, no, these people are not vanishing.
Right.
They're changing, yes. Certain things are being lost while other things are coming to be.
Yes.
But they're not vanishing in their essential self.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other hand, we are all vanishing in a sense. We're all journeying toward our own death and mortality.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, it's like there's the not vanishing piece And then there's the human journey, the life is a sacred journey that we're all finished. So how do we hold those two in tension and not just say, those people over there are vanishing?
Yes, yes. And then what happens, Lynn and sisters and brothers and people who are listening out there, is what happens then we begin to create constructs and systems that are based on invisibility of the individuals. As all of you know, I hate the fact that dementia units are always at the back of the building. That just messes with my whole, like, I hate it. And they always say it's because of safety, and I'm like, really? Because I think you can make them safe without locking them away from the rest of the population and that interaction and that hubbub of life to a place where it's so sterile and so artificial that they begin to zombieize, that's my word, I don't think that word's in the dictionary, but zombieize to that environment and not to an environment that's eclectic and moving and smells and other people. And what is your experience? I know you speak a little bit about that, but what is your experience around that and what are your feelings around that, Lynn?
I love that you use the word safety. I think we often use that word as kind of a shield, and I'm always like, safe for whom?
Mm-hmm.
Who feels safe?
Mm-hmm.
Is it, you know, those of us who don't have dementia yet feel more comfortable?
Yes.
If those persons aren't up front? But in my experience, when I first, my first real job after my chaplaincy training was at a nursing home on the New Jersey Shore. It was a continuum care retirement community with 1,400 people, so it was large. And I was assigned to the facility, again, detached in the back of the,
yeah.
You had to kind of wind around to get there,
yeah.
Where the people most compromised were, and it included a dementia unit. And so on my first day when I was given a tour, five stories, on the fourth story was the dementia unit. And my guide, a perfectly well-meaning, kind person, said, you know, you probably won't spend much time here. And it was a subtle and not so subtle way of saying, you know, with 200 people to your care, the people who most need you are the people who will remember you. So these folks, we'll take care of them. Their physical needs will be, but you should probably go elsewhere. And,
wow.
You know, I found that actually I spent most of my time there. And when my spiritual antenna is working correctly, when it is,
right.
I'm always asking who's being left out and why. And in this case, it was clear that these people were somehow not worthy of my best energy or time. And that's simply reflecting a larger culture that believes that and not this individual's particular prejudice.
Exactly. And I think that's the conversation. I love that you said that. There is a, what is her last name? Applewaite. Oh, gosh. I interviewed her many, many years ago. And she lives in New York City, and she did a whole study on ageism. And all she did was bleach her hair gray and walk around for like a month and see how people were going to treat her. And she said it was amazing, the difference. You know, you go up in your house and you're young, vital, not, you know, she's my age, but still you're considered young and vital and people are resonating, looking you in the eye and treating you with respect. Go upstairs, you put a little bleach in your hair, you come back down and the whole scenario changes. And so what steps do you think that, you know, I always believe in education, and I always believe that it's the way we build our communities and neighborhoods, you know, and I grew up in a different time where elders were in the neighborhood being cared for, so I saw them, I smelt them, I had to learn how to walk around Miss Jones with the walker, and I better help Miss Jones. Or my mother would say, did you walk by Miss Jones and not help Miss Jones? I mean, so So what happened in our society, do you think, Lynn, that got us to this day where we kind of don't see them as elders? We just see them as old people, which is kind of...
I love that distinction. You know, an elder is something of distinction.
Yes.
You know, of respect, and that we know people's names and not this blur of a disability or blur of old people, or, you know, in churches, we can be awfully ageist. You know, we talk about the blue hairs.
Yes.
You know, and that's so depersonalizing.
Yes.
How did we get here is a great question.
Yeah.
You know, I think, you know, not to romanticize any previous time.
No, but
now that we have, you know, diagnoses for so many different conditions, we can use those diagnoses to help people, or we can put them in sort of a straitjacket with it.
Mm-hmm.
And now that we can diagnose you with a particular condition, oftentimes we can kind of like funnel everything through that identity.
Right.
And so you no longer become Michelle with a daughter and a wife and a, you know, church and all these other things. You become Michelle with this diagnosis,
mm-hmm.
and you're a victim. And so I think one piece, and this isn't all of it, is when we have this gift of medicine, advanced medicine, it also comes with some liability. And I think as a minister and as people working in kind of the human side, mm-hmm. of things, I hate to use that dichotomy, but I think so much is how we begin to reframe the narrative,
mm-hmm.
tell other stories.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you can tell the story of disease and diagnosis. You can tell the other stories,
mm-hmm.
Of love and laughter and new manifestations of life,
yes.
on this sacred journey.
Yeah. And I think
we have a responsibility.
Yeah, I was going to just say that. I was just going to say that, Lynn, that we have the responsibility then as we come into these interactions, that we are mindful to stop ourselves and hear the story first. Because you can look at me and come up with your own story, but it may not be, that may not be my story. You may be coming up with a fiction, and so being there, one of the projects that we did here was with a group of students from the Haas Business School, and they were studying volunteering and volunteerism. And they came to ASAP because one of the things that I said in a presentation and one of them heard was that it's easy to volunteer in places where people run around saying, oh, thank you, you're amazing, it's so good to have you here. But the real challenge of our spirit in humanity is when we volunteer with, even a pet will wag its tail, but when you volunteer in a situation where that face, affect, may never say thank you, but when you hold that person's hand, you feel that tiny little mm-hmm. push. And volunteerism then takes on a whole new meaning for you, because then you move from it becoming an exercise to a place where of growth, spiritual growth, as well as a place that brings you joy. And joy to others. And they had to write papers after, and many of them said, we had no idea that people with dementia, Alzheimer's, some others, other forms of dementia, had the ability to communicate.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, like, they thought they were just sitting in a chair, kind of slumped over, staring into space, drooling. I mean, one of them even wrote, you know, they were going to be really mean and agitated and combative and yes, all of that. But at the end of the day, when you create an environment where people are engaged and the people around them are engaged, you see something different. So, Lynn, tell our audience what they see when they engage with a person that that has some dementia if they come authentically?
Well, I think for one, the images we have floating in our culture are exactly what your students were picking up on. And it's very astute. We see, whether it's on television or in magazines, you know, even pictures of half-faded heads or, you know, again, this idea that people are leaving us, and what's left is this shell that drools or is not able to interact.
Mm-hmm.
But I think as we come closer and we begin to stop defining people by what they can't do, I don't want to be defined by that. By my losses,
right,
or what I can't do.
Yep.
When we can begin to approach people as every bit as human, as every bit as sacred, as cherished, as their life, every bit as round as our own, then we can begin to not be so fearful of what we're encountering. That we can kind of come on the level.
A human
level. And even though it may be difficult for us to understand what the words are or what something means, we come in with sort of what I call the intentional stance, that whatever the person is communicating has meaning. I might not know what it is. So in a sense, I might be confused, not them.
I always say that.
I have to work with my own confusion.
That's right.
Instead of saying, oh, they're so disoriented. But what they're trying to communicate is real and true. And even if I can't quite cognitively get it in the moment, I get that it's meaningful for them. And so I try to stay in that moment. And it can really be a gift. I can remember a woman on the dementia unit, and she always had her Bible on her lap, and we decided to start a Bible study together. And, you know, she taught me this, that I have to wait. I have to let silence happen. And so we would start this Bible study, and there's, you know, we get anxious when there's silence.
Right.
So I would, you know, start to feel it. But she taught me if I could just zip it for long enough, she would come forward with something quite beautiful. But we have to kind of let some of our anxiety around performing.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. Yes.
And it's hard. It's a hard spiritual work. That's what you said.
Yeah.
It's spiritual work.
Yeah. And it sometimes will be counter to the policies of your, you know, I've been doing this long enough, and Lynn has too, that 23 years ago when I was saying, well, what about their souls? And what about, you know, we don't talk about that. Fast forward 23 years later, talking about their spirituality and finding out what their faith-based preferences are, figuring out the difference between denomination and creating a real holistic approach to the care is now where we are. But it's just like, why would you not think that that wasn't important to healing? And why does, and I know science is, they're catching up, they're getting there, but science has had to catch up with the faith-based community, and so has social services and advocacy, because they have felt like, oh, don't get so religious. I'm not religious. And so have you had that experience in your work? And would you speak to that?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think as our religious literacy goes up, hopefully as a culture, we can put more stories out there about faith not looking this one particular way, but that it's particular across a spectrum. And so some people, when they hear chaplain or they even hear Baptist minister, if they don't sit to hear my story, they can just project whatever they think that means onto me. And so, yeah, I think, again, it's back to listening to people's stories and their particularity. I think we have made strides, and yet there's still much to go. I can remember just advocating for one of our Jewish residents who had severe dementia to go to a Shabbat service. And one of the managers was saying, no, she'll be too disruptive. She'll be too disruptive. And, you know, we pushed hard as a pastoral care team. And, you know, the managers, we don't want to embarrass her. We don't, you know, what is that about? We can unpack. But
right.
She eventually got to go and was singing the song.
Yes.
Her Jewish community friends holding her hand.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
And, you know, so what if she had an expression that was loud?
Right.
So I hope you're right. I think you're right, Michelle, that there's been strides.
Yeah.
But their advocacy is still needed.
Yes. And advocacy that is multicultural, that is sensitive to what I'm now saying, real life, and bringing forth that, allowing that person to bring forth their essence in their own way and not directing it. Like when I first came to ASAB, like I said, 23 years ago, and again, no ding at anybody, that I was a part of it, we didn't know. We would take the coats and put them on the hanger. We're in adult daycare, so people come in and out every day. We provide respite, and we would hang their coats up. And one day in a meeting, we were all talking, and I thought, and we all thought together, we keep saying we want to provide independence. What is independent about that? Now, if they need help and they're struggling, absolutely. But how can we take the struggle out of this? Well, we put their name, we made those little disc things like you see in the store with their names on the hanger and lit up the closet, like illuminated it, because again, as you get older, many of us, like I have cataracts right now that aren't big enough for them to take out, but you know, vision. But we made it so they could do it. And it didn't matter which way they put. I mean, we found hilarious hangings of coats and sweaters and things. I didn't know you could hang stuff on a hanger like that. But at the end of the day, they did it themselves. And it became an activity of function and an activity of consistency in their lives that no matter what happened, that's what they would do every day. Come in, look for that disc, hang up their coat. There was a woman, nonverbal, and she would automatically go to the bicycle because she had learned that we wanted her to lose weight because it would be better for her diabetes. We didn't have to tell her. And this is a woman, for those of you that don't know, we do many mentals, we do tests, there's a variety of them, the Montreal, there's a variety of them, to measure the person's cognitional level, okay? Well, if the person is in single digits, that means their cognition is pretty, like they may not know what the day of the week is, year and that. But what I have learned is that they are still so alive in there, and they will say things that you'll look and go, wait a minute, I thought Miss Jones didn't know what was going on in the world, and Miss Jones just said something that was right on. How long had she been thinking about it? We don't know. But we count them out before they're out. So that sort of, what do I want to say, assessment in our mind is based on us, though. It's not based on them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point. And how do we... it gets back to questions, how we value ourselves.
Yeah.
How do we judge our own worth?
Mm-hmm.
And if we're counting people out because of their cognition, what does it say about how we assign worth to each other and ourselves?
Mm-hmm.
So if I have a cognitive deficit, do I become less than?
Right.
And so it starts with us wrestling with that question of what
mm-hmm.
gives us worth and meaning. And just that example of the coats is so powerful because it to me, it's the difference between enabling and disabling.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And your team enabled people.
Yes.
And I think often what we call a disability is actually people being disabled by the environment.
I'm going to fix this light. The sun just decided to illuminate us, Lynn. I love it. I was like, all of a sudden, I'm like glowing. And I am inside this conversation, but it just went boom. But I know. But I agree with you. I love the way you said that, because it is a disabling. It is the reverse of what we do with children, where, you know, we would never do that. We would let that child teeter and totter and almost fall without grabbing them if they were learning to walk. But with an elder, we're like, sometimes we create those falls. I've told people that. I said, look how fast you rolled up on that person. You just invaded their whole physical sensory. And you're talking to them, you're making noises walking up behind them, and this person has dementia. And now they're trying to figure out and you create that sort of chaotic movement that results in a fall. And when the CNA said to me, oh my gosh, I never realized that, I said, we have to tread gently on the pathways of people with dementia, because they get overstimulated very quickly and very easily. Mm-hmm. You know, I am animated in the program, but there are days when somebody I can tell is going through something that I take it down. So it's what you said earlier, always being in that moment with the person, because you're going to have to adapt, because they can't.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Absolutely.
They can't.
Yeah, it's such a learning process that for me, working with people with dementia has changed me, is changing me.
And I
feel like if it weren't for them, in some ways I wouldn't, you know, have the joy I do in my life.
Wow.
Because, you know, they've taught me it's okay to change. It's okay to not have it all together. And, you know, I'll speak for myself, but oftentimes women, we feel like we have to have everything together in order to succeed.
Right.
And in some ways it serves us well, and in other ways it's oppressive. And to be around people for whom there's no longer that mask of pretense or perfection,
mm-hmm.
it's really liberating.
It is.
And,
oh, Lynn, yes.
So it's not only just, isn't it nice I'm doing things for them? No, for me it's like, oh, I receive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people have that experience, but we don't often ask people to tell that story. We ask people what's wrong. We ask people what's the hardest part, or tell us it. And not that we downplay that.
No.
Like you said, we listen to the suffering. It is hard. It is difficult. But how do we listen to the untold stories?
And you have stories in here. You have stories in here of experiences that you've had with people in your journey. Is there any one story in here that you would like to share with folks? And again, the book that Lynn wrote, this beautiful, and I hate to say it's just a book because it's beautiful. It's just gorgeous. I love everything about it, actually. And it's On Vanishing, Mortality, Dementia, and What It Means to Disappear by Lynn Castile Harper. And please pick this book up. Get it and then pass it around. You know, that's what I do. I that's why I buy hard copies, because they're more passable. They'll live through many passings. And so get it. And you know, if you are a church, faith-based community, and you're thinking about starting a elder ministry, this would be a great place to start as far as doing a book reading first. And then go into some other, and I can give you a list, but start with something like this, because then you will not be thinking that what you're doing is serving. What you will be thinking is that you're sharing. My friend Nicole Kearney taught me that. She said, it's not about serving, because then you begin to get an attitude. If you're constantly serving, it's that mind shift. But if I'm sharing my life, my time with you, that's a very different place to be. And thank you, Nicole, for teaching me that. So I share that with you, Lynn, because I thought I'm always like, oh, serve the people, serve the people. I wrote it in my grant, serve, serve, serve. And then I realized, well, yeah, after a while it becomes like a, yeah, you just, on the opposite side of the table, serving.
And then when it's your time to be served, oh, no, no. I don't do that. You're right. It becomes lopsided.
It becomes lopsided, and then you get, I think what you said earlier about staff, you know, the staff, we did a thing where we trained all of our staff in the in this system, design model called Montessori and Dementia. And we took a whole year to do it, to train the staff. And it was amazing where the caregivers even said, I see the difference in the staff. They were not just seeing the difference in the participants in the program, but the staff. And I said, well, that's interesting. What did you see? Well, they're more relaxed because they weren't scurrying around doing, enabling. They were partnering with. And when you that changed the whole trajectory of the work, and it made it more exciting to set the table with a participant as opposed to be the person at 11, oh, what, I got to go run and do this. They stopped serving the water. The participants were assigned to serve the water, told the menu. Staff stopped doing that. A participant did that. You know, welcome the people in the morning. Staff stopped doing that. A participant. So all of a sudden, it became their world and not ours. And we were the visitors.
And oh, Michelle, I want to come visit.
You have to. You have to. After COVID, you have to. And I will come visit you as well. But it was hard in the beginning. The staff was just like fighting me. No, we don't want to do it. We like doing it this way. So we had to really push a whole new way of being. And I just, Lynn, When you are as a chaplain and as a person that is also, you know, dealing with death and dying, you know, that when we talk about Alzheimer's, we are talking about a trajectory, of course, that we're all on. You know, I always say we're all on that little choo-choo. Nobody doesn't get on the choo-choo. But at the end of the day, for families, what would be your, you know, for a caregiver or a family or someone observing this, particularly in this time where a lot of folks, we just went back into the purple zone, so nobody's going to be able to go visit anybody. Give them something to help them.
Well, first of all, I just want to say the fact that they're listening today tells me volumes, you know, that you're taking the time for yourself to pour in, and that should never be something that's seen as extra or icing on the cake, but it's a central ingredient. So I just want to commend you for that and say, you know, as a faith leader, oftentimes people will call me at the very last moment, that I've observed that sort of like, oh, you don't want to come see mom or dad or my sister through the journey, but only at the end. And so I want to say for those of you who have faith communities, even if it's a very thin thread, maybe it's just been a long time since you've been connected, reach out to your faith leaders. invite them to be a part of the sacred journey. If they do not wish to be, you may want to find a different community.
Right.
But
right.
I can just share that to me, it's the greatest joy and honor to be invited in. And I'm often waiting for invitations because we don't know what we don't know.
Right.
So I would say, first of all, just if you do have that connection, it's not putting anyone out. It is why we are here.
Mm-hmm.
And the same with chaplains and institutions. Don't assume that they know what your loved one is experiencing, and don't feel like because your loved one isn't particularly religious that the chaplain wouldn't want to come.
Yeah, good point.
So that's where I always want to start.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much to say to that question,
mm-hmm.
Michelle.
Mm-hmm. But that invitation in, because that I think that's important. You know, I'm trying to think of the right way to say it, my family. But it's grief is a natural part of life, and it creates when you live through it and you allow it to live out its existence, because it cycles within yourself, there is a breaking open that happens at some point that gives you the fuel for the healing. But you first have to go deep inside yourself and realize that there are people that will hold your hand along the way, sometimes in silence, sometimes in prayer, sometimes in mindfulness, sometimes in quotes, sometimes putting just lotion on your hands or feet. It could be a variety of things. But when people don't know, we have changed the world. No, people don't, we're afraid to come up to you because we're afraid that you're hearing, we think you're weak, or we think you're not doing it right, or blah, 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 because you've been conditioned. I keep telling people, stop, don't worry. The world did this to us, okay? The world did this to us. And so now what we have to do is deprogram ourselves, and that's okay. And know by doing that, we create a new existence,
mm-hmm.
and know that you're going to fall back on habits, and you're going to, I mean, the Michelle Pope that I was 2 weeks ago is not the Michelle Pope I am today. Even in 10 days, I've changed.
Mm-hmm.
So know that you will change, and be okay to have, another good friend of mine wrote a wonderful book on grief called The Open Broken Heart. Julie Interante, and it's the open broken heart. So your heart is going to get broken, but you have to open it to the possibilities of the newness of that. What happened? And that is dementia.
That is. Oh my goodness. And our task as people who maybe aren't there actively in the same kind of situation of grief is to create the spaces when the heart breaks open that it's safe.
Yes.
Yeah, and that it receives a gentle reception. And that we're not asking people to seal it back up, but that we can, as institutions, whether the one you run, Michelle, or
yep.
the church I'm a part of,
mm-hmm.
wherever we find ourselves, if we can begin to create those gentle landing strips for people
yes.
in their grief.
Yes.
I think it's so important.
Oh, Lynn, I could talk to, oh, man, I want to talk to you all morning. We need a teapot between us, and we can have some cup of chamomile tea, and really, I really so honored to have spent this time with you this morning. I am so honored. So thank you so much. But my friends, on vanishing, I'm going to make sure I get it right. There we go. Mortality, Dementia, and What It Means to Disappear by Lynn Castile Harper. This is a beautiful read. It is a beautiful holiday present. If you are a millennial, let me say this to you. You will be a caregiver eventually. Put this in your toolbox. You may not need it today, but get one of those little plastic boxes from Target or whatever. I don't know what they call them, but they're plastic. You put your holiday stuff in them. You put sweaters in them. And start your caregiving box. There's somebody in your life right now that's aging, and they're going to need you to be somebody that you are thinking now you could never be. So put this in that box. You may not need it right now, but you'll read it later on, and it will be a tool. And I tell people all the time, I tell my son, my daughter, you may not need stuff when you learn it, but put it somewhere because you're going to need it later on. The wisdom comes from everywhere. The truth comes from everywhere. It doesn't just come from one place. And so you really have to go and search it out, and certain things will not resonate with you. But this will resonate with you because these are real. This is a real, truthful story, and it's not fiction. This is nonfiction, and please get it on Vanishing. Lynn, before we close, is there any last words that you would love to share with our virtual family? And we have people all over the world that come to Life is a Sacred Journey, all age groups. I'm so thankful that this is an intergenerational platform. But is there something that you would like to share? I would love to give you this last moment to share with our family something that you think is a great takeaway.
Sure. Well, first of all, just thank you for sharing this part of the day with us. This is just such an honor, and I'm so humbled. And I suppose, you know, for me, the life is a sacred journey that doesn't stop. The sense that whatever comes our way, whatever our caregiving path is, whether we receive care, whether we get a diagnosis, I know in my own family, we have a strong familial link to dementia and Alzheimer's.
Okay.
So that may very well be in my future, but holding on to that sense that the sacred journey doesn't stop when illness comes, and that, in fact, it may take us in a whole other place, but it doesn't make it less sacred. And so I want to just hang on to that. And with your show's title, Michelle, you just, make that easy to make that connection.
Well, and Lynn, you know, we would love to have you back. Let's, we'd love to have you back and continue the conversation. I always say that to everybody that comes. I fall in love with all of my guests, and we become BFFs of the heart. And so you have joined a happy family that dances in my spirit. So thank you so much for sharing your heart and your wisdom and everything that you have learned. And you are an authentic presence in the world of dementia, and we are so honored to join you in the advocacy of saying there's no vanishing. They are here on Vanishing. So this is about that place where people still are, people still live. So, well, thank you, Lynn Castile Hopper, for joining all of us at Life is a Sacred Journey. And I want to thank all of you for joining us every Friday morning at 8 o'clock. Be well. You know, the pandemic, you know, I'm tired too, all right? I am tired too. I have this, I'm on the wrong side, this permanent thing on my face now that's from a mask, because it's probably because I'm allergic to the stuff on the mask, but that doesn't prevent me from wearing a mask. I have to use hand sanitizer. I have eczema. My eczema on my hands is like killing me, but it doesn't stop me from using hand sanitizer. I love my family, and I wanted to be with my son and my daughter-in-law on Thanksgiving. This will be the first time in a decade. But we were not together. My daughter lives in the house with me, and she went on a trip, and I did a air hug and a because she's living out her life as a 21-year-old, and I know all the time not wearing a mask. And I have to come here and be with patients. So please, I don't care what you believe. I really don't, and I'm not putting you down. But we cannot move on until we all put on a mask. Where's my mask? God dog it. I'm going to show you. Put on your mask. This is our Life is a Sacred Journey mask. But put on your mask and carry a little hand sanitizer. Wash your hands every time you're near a sink. Let's not go through 2020 one in the same way. And it means all of us together, stop being angry, stop worrying about what other people do. Just handle your, stay in your lane and handle you, and then we will all be okay. And we don't have to believe what everybody else believes, or you don't have to believe what I believe. But I know this, if you wear your mask, we'll get better, and we can get back to whatever your normal is for you. I'm not going back to any normal. I'm going to a future that I pray is better. But I'm not judging that for you. Please wear your mask. Lynn, I am so happy that you're safe with family in Maine, and I pray everyone around you remain safe and healthy, and thank you again so much for the lifeline that now exists between you and I. Thank you so much for coming on Life is a Sacred Journey. Be well. And may the universe continue to bless your ministry as you do what you do out there in the world. On Vanishing, get it. It's a great Christmas present. Have a great day. Peace and blessings, you guys. Take care. Yeah. Lynn, stay on for 1 second. I'm just stopping everything.
Oh, thank you so much, Michelle.